I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Angola is one of the most notorious prisons in the country, with a history of lawlessness and violence. Our guest, Albert Woodfox, was serving time at Angola for armed robbery when in the early 70s he was accused, along with two other inmates, of stabbing a guard to death. They were all found guilty of murder by an all-white jury in spite of the lack of evidence and sentenced to life in solitary confinement. Woodfox spent 43 years confined to a 6x9 cell for 23 hours a day, allowed out for 1 hour for either a shower or to exercise by himself. He endured mistreatment by the guards, frigid winters, suffocatingly hot summers, mental anguish, and physical ailments. He also fell in love with books, turned his cell into a university, taught another inmate to read, worked for prison reform, and was finally released in February 2016. Albert Woodfox has written a memoir, Solitary, about his tough childhood, his life of crime, the brutality at Angola, and how he transformed himself while in prison. It's written with Leslie George. Albert Woodfox joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on our show. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me read just a couple of sentences from the epilogue from your book. You say, "It took about a year for my body to relax from the positions I'd gotten used to holding while being restrained. I allowed myself to eat when I was hungry. Gradually, over 2 years, I let go of the grip I held against feeling pleasure and of the unconscious fear that I would lose everything I loved." It's now been 3 years since your release from prison. Are you still acclimating to life outside of prison?
Yeah, you know, I'm experiencing a lot of first time. Pretty much everything I do is, you know, first time.
Feels like
experience.
The first time for
yeah.
you.
And, you know, I still have claustrophobic attacks, but it's much easier to deal with. For me, the only solution was to pace. You know,
to pace, so, to walk and pace?
Yeah, up in that. Well, in prison, you know, the cell was only 9 feet long, so, you know. You know, but now that I'm free and I live in a home and stuff, you know, I can go in my backyard. I can go out on the sidewalk. There's a park about a block and a half away, and you know, so my ability to pace now is much greater.
Sure.
But the intensity of the claustrophobic attacks is still.
You still feel that today?
Yeah.
You know, this book is it's beautifully written, but it's also scary. It's about this vivid portrayal of your life, but also of the violence that seemed to be so much a part of Angola when you were there, the kind of fear, the brutality, the lawlessness, the chaos. Did you, in a sense, relive some of those moments as you were writing this book with Leslie George?
Well, yeah, the book, you know, it was a very painful experience. And
it's painful to read, I have to
say. Yeah, and less. You know, the fact that I've known her, she's been a Natri supporter since she interviewed me in 98 when I was awaiting a second trial. And, you know, so over the years, the trust factor has developed between us. And so, you know, when writing this book, you know, I knew that by myself that I would avoid a lot of stuff. It's very painful stuff.
Right.
So I said, well, I need to get somebody to help me who's going to. And since Les had been an A3 supporter so long, and she had proven through her action that, you know, she had earned my trust and stuff. So I asked her, would she, you know, help me write the book?
Well, let's begin where the book begins. You were born February 19th, 1947, in the Negro wing of the Charity Hospital of New Orleans. Your mom was 17.
Yes.
Your dad wasn't in the picture. Your mom later married a Navy chef.
Veteran, yeah.
And it seemed like for a while there was stability in your family life. He lost his job, and he turned brutally violent.
Well, he was, at the time, I think they called him mustered out. You know, he was forced to retire.
Right.
And, you know, being in charge of, you know, the galleys on, he was assigned to an aircraft carrier.
Right.
So he, having that kind of responsibility, having that kind of respect, you know, he had, I think he was a command master chief in rank. And so when he was mustered out, you know, and he had, you know, I guess the military was somewhat sheltered reality as to real reality.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and we were living in a small town in North Carolina, LaGrange, North Carolina, you know. And so, you know, not having that responsibility, not having that respect, not being able to get a job and stuff like that, you know, he became very bitter and abusive.
Right. To the point where your mom basically left with you and another child.
Well, yeah, we, you know, the plan was for all of us to go.
Right.
But my sister was, you know, daddy's girl, and so we were waiting for him to leave. And so he was leave to go by my grandma, and she wanted to go with him, you know. And my mom and everybody, you know, my aunties tried to talk her out of it, but she wanted to go. So then my brother James, he wanted to go.
You describe yourself as a rebellious child. I mean, clearly you were shoplifting. You were. It was a kind of way of life for you. And as you said, in many ways, because your mom was struggling to make a living, there wasn't enough money, there were times you ran out of food, but you described this as trying to outsmart the world. That's what you, as a young person, that's how you viewed what you were doing.
You know, in my book, I talk about the guilt of innocence, you know. I never saw the things I was doing, as a petty criminal, as being, I never stopped to consider the hurt and pain and suffering I was causing other people. It was just survival, you know. It was plain and simple. And so, you know, of course, at some point in time, you know, I began to understand, you know, that whenever you commit crime in society, you're hurting someone. And so, you know, after joining the party, you know, my whole life changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me quote you again. And this was, I just thought, such a powerful section of the book, speaking to what you just said there. You said, writing about this time in my life was very difficult. I robbed people. I scared them, threatened them, intimidated them. I stole from people who had almost nothing. My people, black people, I broke into their homes and took possessions they worked hard for, took their wallets out of their pockets. I beat people up. I was a chauvinist pig. I took advantage of people, manipulated people. I never thought about the pain I caused. I never felt the fear or despair people had around me. And I circled that and underlined it because I thought, it's such a profound thing to say, and obviously a difficult thing to say about oneself.
Well, you know, yeah.
I mean, we all have made mistakes as young people.
You know, but, you know, it was very important to me to be honest in writing this book. And Leslie George, her influence is greatly in the book, which is why, you know, I've had some people, you know, asked me, well, she was just a ghostwriter. Why are you giving her so much standing? And I'm like, well, she earned it.
Yeah.
You know, because there were a lot of issues that I really did not want to deal with. The pain, you know, my theory is pain, you know, I've heard people say pain, you know, it goes away and stuff. Pain never will go away. And something could happen 30 years ago, and someone could remind you the reason for that pain, and that pain is just as intense and hurtful as it was the very first time it happened. At least that has been my experience, you know.
Sure.
So I would have avoided a lot of the issues I dealt with in the book, but Les was able to, you know,
help you
fight
through,
push
it. Yeah.
Scream, you know, and, you know, made me, you know, realize the importance of talking about some of these things. You know, if you want to teach people, if you're trying to raise level of conscience, as you're always saying, you know, make the build a better humanity.
Yeah.
Then you have to let people see this process. It's easy to say, you know, you change. But you have to show people that, you know, change is difficult. But if you determine to change, you can change.
Well, as I said, there are many paragraphs like that in this book that are just kind of stop you short and make you think about what you and your co-author are saying. You went to Angola several times as a young person before being finally sent there for armed robbery. For 50 years you were sentenced there. But your description of Angola is truly frightening.
Well,
I mean,
it
was a frightening place that seemed as if, the guards would look the other way. There was violence all over. You describe the sort of fresh fish day, it was called, when these young new inmates would come and the predators would kind of check them out and figure out who they were going to turn into their sexual slave.
Yes.
And you also describe fighting people off yourself.
Yeah. You know. Well, the first time I went to prison, it was for auto theft. Right. And I made parole. And after you know, at that time, you were eligible for parole when you do 1/3 of your time. So I did 8 months, made parole, went home, got a job and everything. And actually, you know, my parole was violated for unauthorized use of a vehicle. You know, I was working at a car dealership. And I was doing a favor for the assistant manager because, you know, my quitting time had come. But he wanted to have a car delivered to one of the customers. And he asked me, you know, and he said, just take the car with you. Because they had a little car you used to hook on to whoever car you was delivering. And once you deliver their car, you unhook it and you take that car and you drive back to the dealership. Well, I went home, and while I was in, sitting at home, I got a phone call from my sister, her and some friends. They went to a movie theater, and they were being harassed and threatened by some guys in the theater. So I'm like, you know, just stay, you know, stay in the theater. Don't come out. Stay in the area where the concession's at, and you know, I'm coming to pick you up. So, you know, I wasn't, didn't see what I was doing as being wrong or anything, so I just got in the car and, you know, drove. Me. This movie theater was about 5, 10, 15 minutes from where we stayed.
And that was enough to get you?
Well, what happened is on the way back, we were stopped by the police. And I explained to the officers, you know, the circumstance of me having the car. I had your driving license, all the paperwork, but, you know. And then when, at first they had charged me with car theft. Yeah, but after, you know, I got in and stuff. And the guy, he had admitted that he, you know, gave me permission to take the car home. But I was to take the car home and you know, park it and blah, blah, blah. And he was trying to protect himself because he know what he had did was wrong. And so he didn't want to get himself in trouble. So he kind of like just dumped it all on me. Yeah.
And hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Albert Woodfox, our guest on Radio Times today. He spent more than 43 years at Angola Prison in solitary confinement, and he's got a new book. It's called Solitary, Unbroken by 4 Decades of Solitary Confinement, My Story of Transformation and Hope. You can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Albert Woodfox. He and two other inmates were accused of killing a guard at Angola Prison in Louisiana back in the 1970s. And despite the lack of evidence, they were sentenced to life in solitary confinement. He spent more than 43 years in solitary at Angola, 23 hours a day living in a 6-by-9-foot cell. But while there, he fell in love with books. He taught another inmate to read. He worked for prison reform, and he's got a book called Solitary about that experience. Let me just jump ahead, if you don't mind, just because this is really the heart in many ways of your story. A guard was stabbed to death at Angola, a guy named Brent Miller. You and these two other men who happened to be Black Panthers, as you were at the time, were accused of murder. What was in any way the evidence against you?
Well, actually, only two of us, the original charge, it was 4 guys. But Harmon and I were the only one who were members of the Black Panther Party. The other guys was, for whatever reason, I can't for this day. I mean, I knew them, but there was no, friendship or anything. And so I was, but because, Harmon and I had established the only recognized chapter, Black Panther Party in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And we were active in the prison, organizing against corruption and brutality. We had taken on a sex slave market that a lot of security people benefited from. And, you know, we the corruption and the administration and stuff, you know. Right. And we were also fighting a tradition of established families that went all the way back to when Angola was a plantation. So you got this situation where attitudes of former slave owners or overseers or whatever was being passed down from generation to generation until, you know, this time. So you got, you know, people being cultivated and trained to hate and have racist views. Stuff and they have the power of life and death over you because they're prison guards, you know.
Well, we should just say that you met some Black Panthers when you were in a different prison,
and New York.
In New York, and in many ways they turned your life around. They turned you from being a more sort of violent person, frankly, to a someone who wanted to do good in the world.
Yeah, you know. Well, the influence, you know, began in Harlem, you know, as I said, when, you know, I escaped from the jail in New Orleans and
right.
Eventually, you know, went to Harlem. And I went to Harlem because I was familiar with Harlem from the days when I was, you know, a criminal, petty criminal. And so, but this was a different Harlem, you know. You had, you know, this Harlem had, you know, Black Panther Party chapters, and I noticed, you know, Panthers active in the neighborhood, and it was very impressed by them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you were, and these other inmates found guilty of this murder. As you write, the principal witness against you changed his story. There were just all sorts of problems with the trial, including an all-white jury.
Well, they put a blind man on a witness stand during the trial.
Right, just to kind of underscore that there were bloody fingerprints, but it didn't match your fingerprints or others. You were sentenced, though, to essentially life in solitary confinement.
Well, I had already been placed, you know. Right. Brent Miller was found murdered on the 17th. I was the very first one that they locked up for investigation.
Right.
And I was put in a dungeon and beaten and threatened and, you know. And so the next day, the 18th, was the day that me and Harmon was moved to, it's called CCR, closed
right.
cell restriction, and solitary confinement. And I remained there I remained in one solitary confinement or another until I was released.
In 2016.
Birthday, February 19th, 2016.
So there's so many questions about that. One is, and you describe the humiliations, for instance, the fact that the food would be slid to the door, or
yes.
strip searches, that there were certain things that were done to prisoners that didn't seem to have any rhyme or reason, but they were done to, what, keep you in your place, to make you feel,
you know,
less than?
Yeah, in prison, you know, when you enter into prison, the first thing they do is they try to break you down, destroy your sense of self-worth, any pride or dignity. And so that makes it easy for them to control you and to manipulate you with the various techniques they use in the prison system. And so, you know, one of the hatreds towards myself and Harmon is they couldn't break us.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't make us compromise what we believed in. They couldn't destroy our sense of self-worth or the pride we had and the type of human beings we were. You know, the fact that we didn't say one thing and do something else,
mm-hmm.
that we were true to our word, and, you know, we were constantly organizing. And so
you describe, and one can understand fear, I mean, just sort of losing your mind. On the one hand, you were in this cell 23 hours a day. you could talk to other prisoners, so you had at least some access to communicate, but there was no actual sort of human contact with another person.
No, you're in the cell by yourself. I guess you could say it's unique because in Angola, the solitary cells had bars at the front.
Right.
Most prisons, have these concrete, I call them tombs, with a food slot and a little peephole through the top door, right. Where they can look in on and make sure you're still alive. And so you are able to talk. And when you get your hour out, the shower or whatever, you're able to see the other guys in the other cells, but you can only get so like halfway in the hall. You can't go up right up to the cell and talk or anything, but you are able to communicate.
Right. Did that help you keep your sanity in a way, the ability to be able to talk to somebody else?
Well,
to hear that human voice?
Yeah, but more than anything, it made organizing easier because whatever tier I was on, and in this case, Hillary King, other member of the Angola Tree,
right,
had been placed on the tier. So, we would organize a tier. And, we held educational classes. As I say, I think my greatest achievement was to teach another man how to read and write,
How'd you do that?
Well, my mom was functionally illiterate, The only thing she could read or write was her name. So I had seen her with all her tricks, trying to hide the fact that she couldn't read or write. And I recognized these same antics with Charles, and we had become, good friends and stuff. So, I just asked him, he finally admitted,
that he couldn't read.
Yeah. And, I said, well, I can teach you how to read and write, but you have to really want it,
So would you have shared books? Or I'm just trying to imagine
how to teach
someone when they're not sitting next to
you. What happened was, I would come out and I could sit in front of his cell. Like I said, I couldn't get right up to the cell, but I could sit where he could see me. And I actually used a dictionary because, at the bottom page on every dictionary, there's a pronunciation area where they show you how a word spell is, right, the highest pronounced and stuff, and I taught him about vowels and consonants, adjectives, nouns, that's basically the book we use. And after about a couple of months, he gradually started reading other books, he was a great example of what my mom used to say, change is 100% desire and 2% doing, And so it was after about 6 months, he was reading at high school level,
Well, and you said that was your greatest accomplishment.
Yeah, because he said something to me one day. He said, man, you done opened the world to me, And that always stuck with me, And I mean, he was the first, but he wasn't the only man that, I helped learn how to read and write over the decades, because we used to have classes on the tier, and we, we taught guys how to read and write. Mm. We taught guys about history, mathematics, so it was always, that was a part of the tiers we stayed on. We always tried to organize the men to be, a constructive, not destructive.
You do describe in the winter it was brutally cold. You had like one blanket, which obviously wasn't going to keep you warm. And then in the summer, I can't imagine summers in Louisiana in a cell in Angola, but that must have been just suffocatingly hot.
And they didn't have screens, so the mosquitoes were kind of like. And so, necessity is the mother of creation.
Yeah.
So guys develop, mosquitoes don't like smoke. So they develop a way to make, they would take cotton out of their mattress and make what's called smoke balls. And they would, you know, light the cotton in the miller, and it would burn slowly and would create smoke. So that was one of the ways we tried to, you know, protect ourselves from the mosquitoes that pretty much overran the tier. And but eventually they put more fans on the tier as a result of protests and hunger strikes and stuff. You know, CCR evolved.
That's where you were held. It was called CCR.
And but at, when we first went in there, they only had one fan, and that was at the front of the tier. You know, and you know, I can't tell you how hot the summers get there and the humidity. Louisiana is a Gulf port state, so we under sea level, so there's always humidity. And it was very, you know, it was suffocating, and you know, mosquitoes would eat you alive. And you know, some old, you know, you know, you could barely breathe. Sometimes it was so hot, you know.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Albert Woodfox, our guest on Radio Times today, talking about his more than 43 years in solitary confinement at Angola Prison. He's the author of a book written with Leslie George called Solitary. And joining us now is Amy Fedick. She's deputy director of the ACLU's National Prison Project. She directs the ACLU Stop Solitary campaign. And Amy Fedick, I know you have been listening, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome. And let me just do one little quick little thing here just to remind our listeners, if you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation as we talk with Albert Woodfox about what solitary that experience has been for him, some of the work that he's been doing to reform solitary confinement, and our guest Amy Fedick has been doing that as well. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Amy, you've been listening in, and as I understand it, our guest Albert is the longest running. He's spent more time in solitary confinement than anyone in this country. Is that correct?
That is correct. But it's important to remember that many people in this country are experiencing solitary confinement right now. In fact, our best estimates that are on any given day, 80 to 100,000 people are held in solitary confinement. And they're not held for hours or days. They're held for weeks, months, years, and even decades, like Albert.
Well, and in Pennsylvania, in fact, there's a lawsuit from the ACLU's National Prison Project, the ACLU of PA, the Abolitionist Law Center, and two local law firms here in Philadelphia. They filed a class action suit on behalf of, I think, five inmates in solitary confinement on death row in Pennsylvania. How important is that case to the work that you're doing?
Well, that case is absolutely critical, and it's a great example of practices around the country where people are held indefinitely in solitary confinement because of their capital charge. Pennsylvania is not an exception, but we have people in Pennsylvania who have been in solitary confinement continuously for 10, 20, 25 years. Those are the folks in that lawsuit. But there are also other people in Pennsylvania who are being held in solitary confinement, not for decades, but for very long periods of time. So the problem that Albert describes, it's not just a Louisiana problem. It's not a Southern problem. It's an American problem. And we need to wake up to it and change it.
And I should add that the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Commissioner Wurzel, we asked him to join us. He was unable to do so at this time, but perhaps we can catch up with him at another time to talk about this issue. Albert, let me go back to you. And it's a complicated case on sort of how you were able to get out of Angola. I don't think we can do justice to all the various lawsuits that were involved and trials and retrials and all of that. Do you see a place at all for solitary confinement in prisons?
No. Because, you know, solitary confinement is the most horrific, brutal form of non-physical torture. Because when you confine a man to a 9x6 area for 23 hours out of 24-hour period, and no matter you know, what TARs, I call them TARs, like TVs and radios and stuff that eventually was added. Nothing can relieve that pressure of being confined to that small area and not being able to move beyond so many feet.
It's been described as the size of a parking space, I guess, for listeners to understand. If you're in a 9x6 or a 9x or 10x6 cell, that's essentially, that was your world.
Yeah. And add to that the fact that there was no end in sight, that I knew that because of my political beliefs and my membership in the Black Panther Party, because of my activism in prison, I would never be released from solitary confinement. Their intent was to at first drive me insane and then hopefully that I would take my life as other men in solitary confinement had done.
You did not go insane.
No. As I said, I took a cell that was meant as a death chamber and I turned it into I say re-educated myself because I was always a very bright child. And so, you know, I knew how to read and write and stuff like it there. But, you know, I had to supplement that with, you know, reality as composed, as compared to the crap I was being taught in schools. And, you know, and I'm amazed today. I don't think that particularly African-American kids have any idea what it was like in the 60s in this country, you know.
Well, you are, as you say, self-educated.
Yes.
Right? Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Albert Woodfox, and he spent more than 43 years in solitary confinement in Angola Prison in Louisiana. He's the author of a book written with Leslie George called Solitary. Amy Fettig is with us, deputy director of the ACLU's National Prison Project. She directs the ACLU's Stop Solitary campaign. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. So stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Just a recap here, especially if you're just joining us, our guest Albert Woodfox spent more than 4 decades in solitary confinement at the notorious Angola prison in Louisiana, where for 23 hours a day he lived in a 6x9 foot cell. While he was there, he worked on prison reform. He taught another inmate to read, turned his cell into a university. He was released in 2016. He's written a memoir called Solitary. We've been talking about his life, how he endured this isolation, and his work to end long-term solitary confinement in prisons. Also with us is the ACLU's Amy Fettig, deputy director of the National Prison Project, talking about the ACLU's efforts and the use and abuse of solitary confinement in Pennsylvania and in other states. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Amy, let me go back to you. Is there ever a reason for solitary confinement, even, let's say, for short-term, even maybe to protect a prisoner from violence, for instance?
The only reason that you would use solitary confinement is in an emergency, and that really can be segregation. So you can segregate somebody to protect them or to deal with an incident on a temporary basis, but there's no need for solitary confinement. In fact, international human rights standards establish that no one should be held in solitary confinement beyond 15 days. And trust me, 15 days would be a really long time for you or me to sit in solitary confinement.
Is it torture? I mean, is that the definition of solitary confinement?
Indeed, what the Special Rapporteur on Torture for the United Nations has said is that anything beyond 15 days can be considered torture. And it's also true that we know from decades of research that solitary confinement harms human beings, both physically and mentally. The vast majority of suicides and self-harm and self-mutilation happen in prison in solitary confinement units. I have thousands of clients who cut themselves, who try to commit suicide, who lose their minds. We've known this for years and years and years, and yet we continue to do it.
Why? Why do we continue to do it?
You know, it started with the rise of mass incarceration in the 1980s. In fact, solitary confinement hadn't been practiced in the United States since the turn of the 19th century because it was well known that people were committing suicide and losing their minds. But with the rise of mass incarceration, with warehousing, with the lack of programming and the lack of care for rehabilitation, and quite frankly, with systems being overwhelmed with too many people and too many resources, not enough staff, not enough training, what systems did was lock people down. So solitary confinement in the United States, it's not about prison safety. It's not really about prison violence. It's about efficiency.
Well, do you see it that way, Albert?
Yeah, you know, and there's also the control fact, you know. In prison, if a man refused to be handled or treated like an animal, and he's automatically labeled a threat to himself or others. When you lock a man in a cell 23 hours a day out of a 24-hour period, then he's much easier to control. And it also sends a signal to the rest of the inmate population that, you know, if you dare challenge the powers that be, this will be your end result, you know. It serves no purpose. Other than, you know, to break the spirit of the individual, to destroy a sense of self-worth, to destroy, you know, a sense of pride. And that should not be the aim of prisons in this country, you know, to break and destroy people. You know, the aim should be to try to help these people rehabilitate themselves and become productive citizens. Because if you're lucky enough to go back into society, you're going to have to deal with the restrictions of society. Mm. So if you can survive the restrictions placed upon you in prison, it should be easy for you to survive in the restrictions of society. You know?
You were in solitary for more than 40 years, and you describe, and this was being accused of the murder of a prison guard, which you said and others seem to indicate certainly didn't happen, and certainly there were many, many questions that the trial raised. But you also talk about when the newer guards came in, and many of them, instead of being all white, some were African Americans, and that it was different. Perhaps they didn't know the guard who had been murdered, and it seemed as if maybe some of them even believed that you were innocent.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest remarks we used to get from a lot of the new guards is that, you know, when you go to Angola, they got this teaching academy that they have to go through. And so they were like, you're nothing like they say you are. And I'm like, what you mean? They say, well, they talk about you and Herman Wallace, and they use y'all as the example of the worst prisoners thing. Now, this is in spite of we had excellent conduct records. You know, I went by approximately 20 years without a disciplinary report. And while they were calling me the worst prisoner in America, the records that had been accumulated by, you know, classifications, a psychiatric thing, you know, I got the highest marks you could possibly get in an evaluation report. And so, you know, it's just this.
So there was this reputation, and then the guards would.
There was a reputation they created as opposed to the type of human being I really was, because I tried to teach men to have self-respect for themselves and then for others, and, you know, to develop a moral principle, to have a great value system, you know, to develop this, not to give in to every urge or anger that they have. And so, you know. But the one thing that, the only thing that they could see is the fact that me and Harmon and Robert had dared challenge the practices of the prison, their authority, the power they had over life and death.
Amy, let me go back to you. I'm looking at something that this goes back to 2017, but this is the executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections, why we ended long-term solitary confinement in Colorado. And he goes on to say, inmates who commit serious violations like assault will now spend at the most 15 days in solitary and, if necessary, undergo therapy and anger management classes afterward. Is that what you're looking for?
Absolutely. Colorado has transformed its system, and other states are following suit. It's a national movement because prisons and prison administrators have recognized that solitary confinement doesn't work. It doesn't make prisons safer, and it hurts people, and that prisons can be safely and effectively managed much better without solitary confinement. So Colorado implemented the International Human Rights Standards. It's not perfect, but it is a great place to start, and they have gone from having two supermax prisons dedicated to keeping thousands of people in solitary confinement to having only a handful of people in temporary segregation. So that's a remarkable transformation.
And that's the Nelson Mandela rules, right?
That's correct, because, of course, Nelson Mandela spent years in solitary confinement and wrote very profoundly about its impact on individuals. And so the rules are named after him in his honor to stop in solitary across the country and the world.
Are there other states? That was from 2017, that op-ed. But are there other states that are following suit?
Well, there are several bills, actually, being considered in states like New York and New Jersey and New Mexico that will transform their systems. Some of the goals of these bills are to get seriously mentally ill people out of solitary confinement, to make sure that pregnant women and children aren't put in solitary confinement, which unfortunately in many states they routinely are, and to limit the use of segregation to 15 days in places like New York and New Jersey. So there are states around the country that are looking at serious reforms. The possibilities are endless because, of course, the problem is extremely extensive. But we need political support and we need the public to say, look, enough is enough. We don't treat people like this. We don't torture people in our prisons in the United States.
Here's an email from Bob who says the conditions endured by your guests, even for a person guilty of killing, would be in almost every advanced country considered torture and should be abolished. This is speaking to you, Albert Woodfox.
Yeah, well, I agree. As I said earlier, solitary has no purpose other than to destroy a human being. It has no penological goal in mind. I know we can't wave a magic wand and solitary disappears. But it has to be in steps. And limiting what you can put a person in solitary confinement for and limiting how long you can hold that person in solitary confinement. As Amy said, I've endured it. And my personal pain is 15 days is too long.
Mm-hmm.
4 or 5 days, giving an individual the calm down, some stuff. And then move them into a different environment, would be, an ideal situation. But the use of solitary confinement, it just has no purpose whatsoever.
You were there for more than 43 years, as I've said several times. Did you witness people either losing their minds or taking their lives or threatening suicide?
I've witnessed men who have taken their lives.
I've
witnessed men who have cut themselves or inject spit into their body to cause an infection just to get out the cell or go to the hospital. I've seen men go insane. I fought to try to keep men from going insane. Mm-hmm.
How would you do that?
Well, you try to talk to them and you try to raise the level of consciousness. In life, change is usually motivated by your level of conscious weight being raised up. So usually an individual or an incident will cause your level of consciousness to raise up. Example I give, if a child is playing around the stove, and he's puts his hand in the area and he gets burned or he feels intense heat, then, that's a conscious raising example, So that child from that point on, he's not going to do that, So that's, the principle we worked on. If we can educate a person, if we can give a person a sense of self-worth, if we can reestablish dignity, pride, self-respect, you know, a moral code to live by, you know, then we can build up, you know, benefit humanity as a whole. Because a lot of, like right now, you have this movement going on in the country where a lot of the term uses old timers, guys who have been 30, 40 years, you know, guys who are in their 60s and 70s and being released. And it's being
and that would be you, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's not a me. I don't see the moral foundation behind it. It's an economic decision, because when you go to prison, you're young and healthy, and they can exploit your labor and use you. You know, you're a slave of the state according to the 13th Amendment Constitution. You know, they're making profit off of you, but as you get older and your body begin to break down and you begin to develop conditions like diabetes or hypertension or whatever, you know, then you begin to cost them money because they have to, you know, provide you with medical care and medical treatment and stuff, you know. So they're trying to get you off of their budget onto some other part of the state's budget so that they can bring younger guys in prison. And with the creation and the invent of the prison industrial complex now, you know, prisoners represent dollars and cents now.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Sorry to do that to you. I'm just looking at the clock. Here is an email from Margaret. I'll put this to you, Amy. She says, racism is a huge part of our prison population. What percentage of those in solitary are non-Caucasian? Do we know the answer to that?
We don't have great national figures on that because states are not mandated to report who's in solitary, why they're there, how old they are, what color they are, what gender they are. And that's a huge problem, the lack of data, the lack of transparency in the practice of solitary confinement. But in states that have reported, we do know that African Americans and Latinos tend to be overrepresented within solitary confinement units, even as they are overrepresented, even more than they are overrepresented in the prison population in general. And I have no doubt that race plays a role, as it plays a role in all aspects of our criminal justice system. I mean, we simply would not put someone in solitary confinement. We would not torture them if we weren't, as Albert has mentioned, dehumanizing them. And part of that dehumanization is the fact that the vast majority of people in our prisons and jails and juvenile detention centers are poor people and people of color. There is no question about that.
We're almost out of time here. Amy, if I can just quickly go back to you. I mean, we do see some reforms taking place within the prison system, and some of them supported by prison commissioners and others within the system. Do you see solitary confinement and the questions raised about that as part of this slow-moving reform movement?
Absolutely. It is one of the drivers of reform because when we talk about solitary confinement, when we see what our prisons and jails are doing to people, we have to come to the conclusion that this system is broken, it doesn't work, and we can do better. And in fact, prison administrators, politicians, leaders, and communities that are impacted by incarceration are speaking up and speaking out and demanding that we do better and that we change. And we can. We really can.
Well, Amy, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. She's the deputy director of the National Prison Project for the ACLU, joining us from the NPR studios in, I believe, Washington, D.C. Albert Woodfox, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And we've been talking about his life, and he's got a new memoir. It is called Solitary. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.